welcome back to your Super Sore Away Big Mouth, the nation's favourite for pop culture talk, give or take one or two others. I'm Andrew Harrison, and with me as usual, it's Sian Pattenden, the iron-willed Gene Rook to my wet and sensitive Tim Dowling. Hello, Sian, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
It's newspaper jokes this week because we're doing the newspaper drama Press on the BBC later in the show. How has your week been?
It's been wonderful, thank you.
Has it? Are you going to expand on that, or just generally wonderful?
Just generally wonderful.
It was quite nice having Orbital in last week, wasn't it, as our talkative rave guest?
Absolutely, and weren't they talkative? And did we not talk about dragons so much? That was fabulous.
Yeah,
really enjoyed it.
Were they what you expected?
I've learned never to expect anything from anybody anymore, which is good. But the lovely lads,
lovely lads.
I'll be down the front on their tour.
Yes, absolutely, quite right. Our first special guest for today is an author and journalist who cut her teeth on the NME in the 80s when it was exceedingly woke. She also wrote for Spare Reb and was music editor of City Limits, and she was there in the early days of the world's greatest magazine, Select. She's written acclaimed biographies of Dusty Springfield and Annie Lennox, and her Madonna book, Like an Icon, is out now in a brand new edition. It's Lucy O'Brien. Hello, Lucy. Welcome to Big Mouth. How you doing?
Hello.
And NME was super politicised in your time, wasn't it?
It was.
They should bring it back because it would fit
Absolutely.
The times now perfectly.
Totally. I mean, we used to have interviews with the what was then the Provisional IRA. Everyone from them to Martin Amis to J.G. Ballard.
I remember the headline on the Martin McGuinness interview was Absolute McGuinness because the Bowie movie was out at the same time.
Yes.
It was
yes.
very different from the final incarnation of the NME where it was like BoJack Horseman and a Topshop wraparound.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It seems like a golden age, and in a way it was, because we had so much freedom to write. I remember one entire issue devoted to the whole theme of noise. So
I remember that one.
Oh, I like that.
I don't think that would have been part of the giveaway that they were handing out at Vauxhall Tube, shortly before its demise.
That was Paul Morley, wasn't it, writing about noise? We should get him on the show. Yeah, that'd be an interesting idea, that, wouldn't it? So if you had, now, that version of NME, you could have Corbyn, gender issues, mental health. You did the famous teenage suicide cover, which is now totally current.
Well, that's the interesting thing. That youth suicide cover, I remember going into the editorial meeting and having to really argue my socks off for that one. And people saying, no, felt is more relevant. We need felt on the cover. And then it's very interesting that now it's one of those real collectibles on eBay. It's become sort of a legend, partly because Kurt Cobain famously had a copy sort of on his
So it's your fault.
Wall.
It's your fault.
I hope not.
It'd still be around if you hadn't written
not.
The inside. I mean, it's kind of that mental health. It was actually part of the NME in its final incarnation. They even got into trouble by doing
Stormzy on the cover.
Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, that's the wonderful irony of these things. Part of the problem with when a number of the section editors were sacked in, I think it was 1987, was for the use of Geiger's Penis Landscape. And then a few years later, up it pops in NME. Oh, so it's all right then.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
So the goalpost did keep shifting.
So if we were to crowdfund it and bring it back as like the Teenage Guardian, we'd probably do really well, wouldn't we?
Absolutely.
NME
I mean, I think there's a really interesting young political generation coming up. My son, who's 16, and he's just done his GCSEs. The memes after every GCSE were amazing. You know, you went onto Instagram. I think we've got a new punk generation coming through now.
Doing GCSE memes on Instagram. That sounds like an individual feed.
Our other guest is a Big Mouth regular. She's a graduate of the Smash Hits, Mix Mag and Face Schools of Excellence, now a writer for The Observer and Vogue. She reviews radio and she's on the telly a lot. It's Miranda Sawyer. Hello, Miranda.
Hello.
Who's the front runner for the Radio 2 breakfast show? That's what I want to ask you.
Okay, well, so it should be Sarah Cox, I would say, if all goes to plan. However, there seems to be an indication that it might be Zoe Ball, who would also be very good, but I just think Sarah Cox, for me, would edge it because she's funnier and kind of warmer. The problem they've had for a really long time is that they've tried to entice people like Zoe Ball onto the network, but A, they didn't want to shift any of the blokes in the daytime, and B, actually, you know, that Zoe was quite busy. She had children, she had other things to do, but now I have a feeling that she might think, okay, this is a great opportunity if they offer it to her. But I do think it should be Sarah Cox, really.
What do you think the slot needs to get people up? And
well, it needs a kind
not
of
listening
weird...
to the Today programme.
Well, okay, so, you know, if I'm being completely honest, I couldn't stand Chris Evans, so I'd never listen to him.
What a controversial opinion.
I know. But it was quite difficult because he was genuinely the most popular broadcaster in the country. That was the biggest show radio show in the country. So it's a big deal. So you can't kind of alienate a certain amount of the audience, which is why people like Sarah Cox are quite good, because she covered for him. But you have to be obviously upbeat, jolly. Mm. But the Radio 2 does like a little bit of kind of tabloid controversy, mm-hmm. which is why people are, you know, Zoe Ball, who whatever Zoe does, she will always be on the front page of the, or will be commented on the Daily Mail. So I think that she just slightly edges it weirdly for those reasons. And I wanted to make a point, which was that actually all the people, all the front runners for the job are women, pretty much, apart from Simon Mayo, and he wouldn't do it and he won't get it. So they are all women. But what's interesting to me is they are women who are kind of deemed acceptable as a kind of pseudo bloke. It sounds a bit weird because they're not blokey at all, but because they came from the 90s,
right.
And I'm thinking Zoe Ball, you know, Zoe Ball, Ladettes. Joe Wiley, Sarah Cox, they were kind of deemed ladettes. So it's like they are women that, it's okay because they can all slot into a slightly blokey form.
Acceptable
type of woman. So Middle England is ready for a blokey sort of woman.
Yes, a kind of cheerful one that doesn't go on about, you know, menstruation or anything.
Yeah, I think that's a good phrase.
Bloke bird.
Cheerful bloke bird.
Yeah. We used to have girly bloke pop in Smash Hits, and I was going to bring that to what we're talking about.
Girly bloke pop?
Yes, exactly. Speaking of which, on the show this week... I'll mention it. I'll tell you. Now you can think of all the banners that might be girly bloke pop as we speak. As Andrew mentioned earlier, press we're talking about on BBC One. Can you make a rip-roaring newspaper drama work in an age when you literally have to give dead tree media away? Plus, it's gender-fluid rock and roll. As we have the new albums by fourth-rank Gaelic chanteurs, Christine and the Queens, a young Johnny Depp in a female body, maybe, and also Suede, who are old hands at the away with your gender stereotype stuff. And there's a huge, I mean, it's massive box set of Miranda's favourite Bobby Gentry coming out. And of course, we'll talk to Lucy about the latest edition of her Madonna book. All after these reminders from my glamorous assistant, Andrew.
If you want a bit more Big Mouth every week, why not back us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon? We need to cover our studio costs, so we're asking listeners to make a small contribution to keep us in rude health. And in return, we're recording an extra bit every week exclusively for Patreon backers. If you can spare the mere price of a pint of beer every month, let's face it, it's going to be £5 anywhere decent, then we can keep the weekly pop culture chat flowing like fine wine. And Patreon backers can go to our page on Patreon and hear a bit of additional conversation just for them. That's patreon.com/bigmouthpodcast to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint.
Right. Let's start with Like an Icon, Lucy O'Brien's definitive Madonna biography that's out now in an updated edition 10 years after its original publication. Lucy interviewed scores of dancers, producers, musicians and collaborators to build up a picture that outrageously concentrated on the music and the art rather than the boyfriends and the private life. Why she did it, what sort of picture emerges, and what has Lucy discovered over the subsequent 10 years? What happens in the uncharted territory of the female pop star in her 60s? Gasp. We'll talk about this after the track, which is Lucy's choice. It's this the sexiest record ever recorded. It's Madge with Justify My Love.
I don't want to be your sister either. I just want to be a lover. I want to be your baby.
Madonna's Justify My Love from back in 1990, although it sounds like it could have been made 5 minutes ago, actually. Lucy, you didn't actually like Madonna at first, did you?
Yeah, I wasn't sure about her. I thought she was a bit, you know, just like a disco pop artist who would be here today, gone tomorrow. But then I saw that Like a Virgin tour. I didn't go to the American tour, but I saw her. I saw that special on Channel 4. And I thought she had a real rapport with the women in the audience. And she had a whole energy about her that was different. And then once Desperately Seeking Susan came out, the film, you got to see her as this sort of quite streetwise New York clubber, and that gave another side to her. And then she started bringing out more and more interesting work. And then I think it's a sort of gradual really appreciating her more and more over the years. So going from that to the Like a Prayer album, where she kind of dissected the Catholic patriarchy, and then to the whole sex era, like with Justify My Love, where she was really exploring desire and fantasy. And then on and on through the different incarnations. I think she is an amazing conceptual artist.
So why write a book? What were the other things that were around? Why did you think that you could make a difference and interview everyone in the world ever?
Well, what I noticed when I first did the book 10 years ago, all the biographies about Madonna, firstly, there weren't any written by a woman.
Oh,
right. And also, they were focusing on the more sensational side of her life, her relationships, her sexuality, with really scant attention paid to her music or her work. And I thought, well, this is actually a feminist issue. So I wanted to really almost be like a fly on the wall in the studio. So what's it like making an album with Madonna? What goes through her head when she's getting those shows together and the dances together? And that was the drive behind interviewing choreographers, film directors, musicians, to really build up a picture of Madonna as a woman and as an artist.
What does she represent? Did she represent something very different at the end of the book to you as an artist than when you started it?
Yeah, I was really surprised because I don't know why, but she plays it down, her musicianship.
Okay.
I was surprised at how able she is as an arranger, and she's also really brilliant at melody. And that's what came through very strongly in all the interviews that I did. As a producer as well. So she has this aesthetic that runs through every album. It's not like Britney Spears, where someone kind of hands these things on a plate.
Mm, mm.
It is all her.
Had you met her before you wrote the book?
I had an encounter in... there was a Frankie Goes to Hollywood party in the
80s. My ears are pricking up there. What?
And there was this very diminutive young woman. She looked like a little girl, actually. Mm. And she was dancing, and she had a baseball cap on. It was a bit like... I remember Marilyn Monroe had a story of... she was talking to a fan and she said, "Watch me walk down the road." She walked down the road. Normally, nobody recognised her. Then she said, "Watch me again." And she walked down the road as Marilyn Monroe and everyone really recognised her. And I think Madonna's the same. And this is what a lot of people said. She has a public persona and a private one. That's a long way of saying that at the party, she was in her private persona. So I had to look twice because
right.
It just looked like she was just on the dance floor, giving it her all, really enjoying it and not wanting attention, quite interestingly.
Mm-hmm. She once wore a T-shirt that said, "Short people try harder."
We
always
do.
I always felt much warmer to her after that. Miranda, you've interviewed her a couple of times. What surprised you about her when you met her?
And weirdly, how familiar she is. So, you know, what's really weird about Madonna is, even if you don't like her, I do like Madonna, then you know her. Like, you know a certain... You know what she looks like. So she walks in, you think, "Oh, my God, it's you." Like, not like... She's a star. Obviously, she is a star, but she came in quite low key. She didn't have an entourage. She was pregnant with Rocco. So it's that kind of music era. She had dark hair. And it's just things like, you know, she's got the gap in her teeth. And you think, oh, of course. Why would you not? And also, this is also going to sound a bit weird, she's immensely good looking, like much, much more than you think. Because obviously, she doesn't... Although she sells herself with how she looks, she doesn't really sell herself as being good looking. It's a kind of slight, subtle difference. I think she changes her look a lot and she wants to be attractive, but she's not like a model, if you know what I mean. She's not saying all the time, "You heterosexual man must fancy me in this format," if you know what I mean. She does it sometimes, but not in other ways. And she tries to be scary. So she is immensely beautiful. I mean, she was kind of, you know, as they say, glowing with pregnancy. Mm. And then she was... pretty honest. She had a weird... She was at the time when she had that weird British accent. Do you remember? She had a slightly British accent, which is quite funny.
And also you take her tease.
Yeah, yes. Like it was quite funny. But then also she was constantly checking herself because whatever she said, she was very conscious would then go out into the world and be tabloidified, if you know what I mean. So there was a couple of times when she couldn't... it seemed like she couldn't really... talk freely, but actually I liked her, which is, you know, which is not necessarily, you know, I know that you interviewed her, Andrew, and you did not like her.
I was going to ask.
I did her for Mixmag when she was, I think that was probably about the same time. She just put out music, and she was like, "I am, you know, returning to my. I was always a clubber. I've always loved club music," which is correct. And, you know, that was a great record. I actually found, maybe it was me, I found her rather brittle and humourless. I find it, I've talked to a lot of people who've talked to us since, and they've said humour is not her great suit.
You know, she's not kind of witty.
She's not a repartee person. No. She just, you know, she's not Mrs. Bantz. And I was a bit surprised by that, because I thought you can't get to be that big without being able to see the slight, you know, the absurdity of fame and the craziness of it. But actually, maybe that's what has got her there. Maybe a total lack of a sense of humour enables you to look at everything in an unironic manner and just go, I'm just going to steam ahead. My job is to become the most famous woman in the world. I shall do that without ever questioning.
No, I don't think it's that. It's more like, I mean, she does think things are funny, but I wouldn't say that she's kind of got a kind of quick, like a word wit. You're amazing with words, aren't you? That's your thing. And she's not really that. But what she is, she's got quite a strong sense of camp, which is funny.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and an occasion, which is also funny. It's just not kind of witty repartee. You know, she's not going to be, you know, sitting around in the Algonquin club or whatever, you know. Yeah.
I think it's a kind of daft humour.
Yeah.
So that I think what you see there is that public persona, that, and she's incredibly guarded when it comes to her public persona.
Yeah.
But when she's kind of relaxing, just talking to people who work with her and friends, she's quite childlike. There's a real sweet side to her. And I always remember some footage of, it was backstage at a party, and she had this giant inflatable dildo that she was playing.
We've all, you know, got one of them in the back room.
And she'd had one or two glasses of wine, and Guy was sort of trying to get her to sit down and behave, but she wouldn't, because she was just enjoying herself too much.
Yeah, you don't want a controlling husband if you're a Madonna, really, do you?
Yeah, the long-suffering Guy Ritchie.
He didn't suffer that long, Lucy, which is really great. She is notoriously kind of a control freak. So the thing I would imagine is really hard to write a book about her is it's like the opposite of Lily Allen book. Lily Allen book comes out, and basically it was written with somebody else, and she sat down and told her story in an immensely open way. So that's one way of writing a book about somebody. Yours is like the opposite. There's no way you're going to get to Madonna. Yeah. So how did you manage to negotiate around her without her people coming down and saying, I'm sorry, can't talk to her?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, that one. So I started researching it when my kids were really tiny. 7 o'clock in the evening, I'm feeding my sort of two-year-old, and who's screaming. The phone rings, and it's, hi, it's Liz Rosenberg in New York. And I'm thinking, oh my God, right phone call, wrong time. But it happened that I was going out to New York a few weeks after that to do some research. I had a meeting with her. And so Liz is Madonna's right-hand woman. I mean, she's retired now, but she was her right-hand woman. And it was just a really good opportunity to explain what I was doing with the book, and saying pretty much what I've just said now about wanting to focus on her as a musician and an artist. And obviously that got relayed back, because then I had quite a fair amount of access to all those people that had worked with her. So while she wasn't officially endorsing it or making it an autobiography, I had quite a lot of access.
She hadn't put the hit out on you like they sometimes do.
No.
So don't talk to this person.
And you definitely know,
and that
it.
Will
you
happen.
Know it when that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, there's,
so you didn't have to go through her bins or anything. So
I'd love to go through Madonna's bins.
It'd be all organic stuff, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So how do you feel about, Lucy, the past decade, Madonna's work and Madonna the person? You've revised it 10 years after the time. What's that decade told us? What's new about
the biggest thing for me is how she was famously in control, and that's what we all saw. And then what was remarkable for me was the 2016 Billboard speech, where she won Woman of the Year. And she just stood up there looking bloated, looking really vulnerable, saying, actually, you know, the music industry has completely done me over. And saying I'm a victim of it as much as, you know, any other star female artist. And I thought that was really interesting, that even Madonna, the music industry completely got to her.
But do you believe that? I always see her as so Teflon-coated. And there's lots of hints in the book about how the idea of her mum dying, and also this idea that she was sexually assaulted as well in New York, made her really super tough, and nothing can penetrate that. Do you see the vulnerability? Because that's the thing that I still find really hard.
Yeah. No, I think she made herself tough. She and that's what drove her to the top of that 1980s music industry. I mean, that was a difficult industry to conquer. But I think just she's definitely mellowed in the years between her 50th and her 60th birthday. I think she's realised an awful lot. And she's, I think there's something about reaching 60 where someone looks back and really thinks about what's happened. You know, really thinks about what's happened. She doesn't have to compete anymore with women like 25, 30 years younger than her. She's in a different place now. And I think that's what comes through.
Do you think we've ever had a still active pop Valkyrie in her 60s before? Who hasn't gone tasteful and has just sort of
releasing,
ballads into the US market.
Apart from Joan Collins, I can't think of anyone else.
Cher. Grace Jones.
Cher. Oh, so we've got a few,
Grace Jones.
Grace Jones is, I think Grace Jones is in her own lane, though, because she was never as big as Madonna, and also she's a career mentalist.
And also she's kind of what she likes to be, career what she says is a kind of, not a muse, but to interpret other people's ideas is what Grace likes to do. Yeah. She's not what Madonna really likes to do. She likes to take people's ideas and work them into her idea.
Yeah.
Totally.
So where do you think she'll go next, Lucy? If you were her manager, what would you be advising her to do?
She's got a new album coming out and a tour. And she's been working with Mia Way again, who she worked with on music. And I think that's great.
I hope it's a dancing one. Yeah. I like the dancing one.
Got it, the bangers. Yeah. Got it, the bangers.
And she likes her young rapper producers, so I think there'll be collaborations there.
I think about Pilates.
I think we're still going to see kind of quite rhythmic electronic pop music, I'm sure, that. And maybe some spoken word in there, maybe quite a political album again.
You know what she might do?
What?
Put her kids on it.
Oh, God, no, please.
Well,
the
kids were in the studio.
Always happens.
They were for a few tracks.
Oh, so we might get some anti Trump vitriol for some 10-year-olds.
Hashtag Me Too feminism.
I wish she'd leave her face alone. That's the only thing. I wish she'd just look older.
Be herself.
It's a difficult one, though, isn't it? Oh my gosh.
We could talk about literally for an hour. But Andrew will get bored.
Yes. We'll do the Madonna Maquillage podcast at another time. Yeah. Let's move on and have some more but different music. It is Gender Nonconformist Week. Miranda Sawyer, what record have you brought in for us to play?
Oh, yes, great. I have brought in John Grant, who we all love, or if you don't love, leave the room. And he has got it's a track that's been out for a bit, but he's brought a video out, which is really great. So check it out on YouTube, kids. And it's a bit like Sledgehammer. That's the old person's way to refer to it, but it morphs into lots of things. But it's about going. The track is about getting on the dance floor, and it's called "He's Got His Mother's Hips."
He's got his mother's hips. He thinks he's going downtown now. He's smacking his lips. Does not speak your language. Watch your back. His tongue is super dangerous. He's got his thighs and his roller skates on. You are rolling the dice. He wants you on the ice.
That was John Grant with "He's Got His Mother's Hips," or "He's Got His Mother's Hips," as chosen by Miranda Sawyer. And continuing Gender Nonconformist Big Mouth Week here on Big Mouth, two of the week's most enticing albums are here to totally shake you out of your square bubble. Heloise Letizia, a.k.a. Christine and the Queens, releases her second album, Chris, which takes her electronic pop onto the widescreen and sees her adopt a new masculine identity. What's it like and is it any good? And Anomic Consumptive Beanpoles Suede are, of course, old hands at the non-conventional masculinity thing. What is their new one, The Blue Hour, getting at? Here's a taste of both albums.
Fingers and we listen, come that you're good looking, girlfriend. Don't feel like a girlfriend. But lover, damn it, be your lover.
Look up to the sky and become
Christina and the Queens with Girlfriend from Chris, and then Suede with Life is Golden from the Blue Hour, both out this week. Let's start talking about Christina and the Queens first. Miranda Sawyer, you're not just an admirer, but a personal interviewer of her. You've just done her, haven't you?
I have just done her. So I just, I have to say, you were referring to it incorrectly. Now you have to call her Chris. She has dropped Teen and the Queens. I interviewed Chris on stage at the Curzon Soho in front of about, 250 fans on Sunday night, and it was one of the most extraordinary on-stage interviews I've ever done. So, I do it a bit, and you have a chat about the album, and then you say, are there any questions? And a few people put their hands up. And when I got to, are there any questions, after 45 minutes, every single person in the audience put their hands up. I mean, it was just unbelievable. Oh. Everybody wanted to talk to her. And the beauty of the audience was that it was mostly young people, mostly it was kind of split between gay men and young women who were gay or straight or, you know, in all sorts of kind of manifestations. And what was really gorgeous was that whenever they asked a question, they would preface it with just a short speech of what Chris had meant to them. And it was immensely moving. And their questions were kind of unbelievable. There was one, a great one, from a drag king called Orlando, who said, what is masculinity when it is divorced from the male body? And answers? Whoa. Anyone? Whoa. I mean, it's unbelievable, but that's actually the kind of thing that she's trying
being interested in trains, like tanks, and, I don't know, golf, football.
She's trying to deal with it on the album. So the first album, Christina and the Queens one, is a slightly, it's teenagey, I would say. It's slightly angsty. It's quite lush. This one, the production techniques are really different. It reminds me of a bit of Prince, of Michael Jackson. And it's about sexuality. It's about her sexuality, and it's about her claiming her sexuality and exploring it in different ways. So there's songs about her fancying a kind of young, quite foppish young man, and there's also a kind of butch woman involved. There's one called $5, which is fairly obviously about paying for sex. The videos that accompany these the tracks are really, really interesting, and all the videos are her ideas. She gets other people to make the videos, but they're very interesting. And obviously, a lot of it is around dance. So when I spoke to her, I asked about the concept around the album, and she thinks she trained in theatre direction. So a lot of what she thinks about is the staging of the of the songs. So the dancing that she's doing, some of it is quite West Side Story-ish, not quite as upbeat as that, but that sense of a gang around you, a male-female gang that's kind of supporting you or challenging you at certain points. That's all part of the staging of the album. I think it's really terrific. I think it's going to be a huge hit, I have to say. I think it's great. Because it's also brilliant pop songs. You play any of the songs and people are like, oh, that's good. Yeah. Like Girlfriend, you know, I mean, how can you resist that track? It's so great.
Lucy O'Brien, girls who want to be boys who look like girls and boys who look like girls and want to be boys. This is kind of your specialist subject. You wrote a book about it. Women in Pop and Sexuality. Well, what did you make of this one?
I love her album, and that track Girlfriend, I just think is
the best.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Prince's Kiss. It's one of those pop moments. And the dance with her gang around her, her gender fluid gang. I mean, it's brilliant. It's so of the moment and where young people are now, and just captures the way people are thinking. You know what? One of the thoughts, apart from Cameo, was also Annie Lennox, because I thought if Annie Lennox was starting now, she would be doing something like this. That back then it was called androgyny, and kind of that masquerade of wearing a suit and entering the domains that you're not meant to go into. And I think Chris is doing that in the way that's really relevant for now.
There was a really interesting... Kate Mossman did an interview with her the first time round, so for the first album, and she in it was kind of talking about her wearing suits. And Christine then said, it's interesting because if you wear suits, you get called a good feminist. She's been called a good feminist by people in France because she's not showing her body off. And she said very presciently, oh, but that's just because I haven't had enough sex yet. Like, once I've had some more sex, then it will become different. And it's almost like she threw that idea forward and then moved into that idea. So now she's having lots, or have had, or is having lots of different sex with different types of people. It then becomes more erotically charged, which I think that, although Annie Lennox was sexy, she wasn't necessarily sexual in her videos. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. She was kind of looking at the gender stereotypes and finding a way to step outside them in the music industry. And that was really relevant and right for then. I mean, I think it's quite a different industry now.
It's more, yeah. I think almost Chris is more a bit like Prince. Do you know what I mean? So Prince is like, you know, he's saying, here I am, I'm really sexy, but ooh, I'm going to make you feel a bit
pansexual,
weird because I'm slightly feminine.
Ambisexual,
I'm
all
pansexual,
that stuff.
I'm bisexual, I am just sexual. So deal with it.
Sex on a stick, as Kylie called him.
I love it when she sings in French as well. You get more of a sense of her and... The passionate and the real sexual side of her comes out in some of the songs where she's singing in French.
Who does she look like more on the cover? Is it Elvis? Is it young Johnny Depp? Or is it young Jules Holland? I'm going for young Jules Holland.
No way, man.
He's a good-looking guy in his time. Bit of boogie-woogie feminism
Elvis.
Piano for you.
Don't you think? Young Elvis.
Yeah, a little bit of Elvis out of all of them.
But that is the kind of archetype of hot young bloke, isn't it? Young Elvis, quiff. Looks a
or
bit
James Dean.
Or James Dean. Yeah.
And also, there's also a slight kind of, because it's got, the quiff is a little bit sweaty. You know, it's that idea that, hey, I might have been working outside on some kind of building site.
Or I might have just had some amazing sex with someone in the toilet.
Yeah. Possibly even on a building site, So this is basically the male equivalent of a Betty Blue poster on the wall.
It's
isn't
it?
She's
of
so
a window
sexy.
Cleaner, isn't it?
That's her next album, Christine and the Queen's Confessions of... In, what's French for window cleaner?
Nettoyage de windows.
Yeah. Let's move on to Suede. Now, they're very much our vintage, aren't they, Suede? Yeah. They're very much our contemporaries. This is their third album since they got back together again. They've kind of reinvented a new format since they reunited. The rock album that flows together like a DJ mix. It's a complete work. And all the old Suede drama is in there, the big guitars and the melodies. Lucy, did you enjoy The Blue Hour?
I did. And you know what? Part of the reason I did was because I've just read Cold Black Morning, Brett Anderson's memoir. And I think, you know what, I just thought, I can see this being brought to the stage and screen, you know, as a musical, in the same way that Pete Townsend did with Tommy when he was singing about his childhood. Because a lot of the songs on this album reflect that brooding atmosphere of the memoir and this strange family that he had with these parents who lived like they were in the Bloomsbury set, but they were in this tiny little council house in Haywards Heath. And you really get a sense of that through the songs.
Yeah.
I mean, they're huge and they're kind of mad prog rock. But I think there's a real poetic heart at the centre of them.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fine line between inimitable, this is totally Suede, and slightly self-parody, and it depends whether you like them or not, doesn't it? I mean, I'm totally on board for songs called Fly Tipping, Roadkill, and Don't Be Afraid If Nobody Loves You. That's like, I'm totally
fly
on board.
Fly Tipping,
for a lot
definitely.
Of people, yeah. Fly Tipping.
But what do you think about Roadkill? Because I think that's quite interesting. So Roadkill as a track is basically Brett talking about finding a dead bird, and it's kind of very beautiful, but it's also, if you take one step back, madly pretentious and kind of portentous.
Yeah.
So you have to buy into the Suede world, I think.
Absolutely, and I love madly pretentious. Mm.
What I think is that Suede have gone back and they've listened to Lou Reed's The Raven.
Ah, interesting.
Based on a Edgar Allan Poe poem. And that is a concept album. It's very, very dark. It's also about a raven. It's about the earth. So from J.G. Ballard's Suede of concrete and blocks to the Ted Hughes Suede of finding stuff in the earth and things coming out of nature.
It's literally Old Crow.
It is a concept album. And when I first put it on, I thought, God, this is awful. This difference. Really? I get it. And I could see
it takes a while.
It does take a bit of a grower, isn't it? And then there's so much delicacy and beauty. Yeah. There are hooks.
There's such drama.
The musical hooks that then don't go anywhere, that just leave you. They're not repeated. I think it's really beautifully put together, and it is a concept album, must be embraced for this Brett the man in the wellies and his son saying this is death, mate. You know,
that's
rather
that.
Wonderful.
And, you know, really, he's moved to the countryside. Yes. And what do you do if you're Brett Anderson in the countryside?
Yeah.
I mean,
fly tipping, looking for dead birds.
I mean, I interviewed him and I said, do you do gardening? He said, well, no, of course I don't. I just wander around the garden and point at bits that other people have to do. And then, you know, so then, but he has the time to create. So he wrote Cold Black Mornings, and now you can kind of, you know, you've got the time. Winter in the countryside is just terrible, which is why none of us live there.
Listeners might be living there, Miranda, in your metropolitan media bubble.
Yeah, I know. But I do not like the countryside in the winter. And there's nothing to do. You have to create. And so if you use that, which she has done, it's just...
It's wetter,
you can feel the drama
in
it.
It's puddles. It's things being half hidden in the landscape.
I do think there's a link between him writing that book and then creating this album. I think it kind of paved the way. away, sort of reflecting on that, reflecting on what he did. Because I, in the past, I used to feel that Swade were a little bit superficial, dare I say it, whereas I feel there's real depth to this album.
Yeah, well, it's definitely, they've moved on enormously from, I think, you know, because their world was very defined. Consequently, you can do Dogman Star or you can do a Coming Up, but within the kind of two ends of that continuum, there are not too many variations. And what they found is a third dimension. Yeah. You can make these, you know, you can make these movies for the ear. You can make these. And the last one, Night Thoughts, is also amazing. And I think this is actually better. This is this is grander and more exciting. But like, I just think it's great that a band at this stage of their career can suddenly find a brand new thing to do.
All right, it's time for some more pop music. Lucy O'Brien, what have you brought in for us?
So I've brought in this track called The Flu by, she's an artist, Lily West, who calls herself La 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 La, and the album is The Lamb. And it was one of those things that I stumbled across. She's been touring with some really good kind of feminist pop, indie pop bands like Girlpool, Chastity Belt, and she's just got a real original voice. She's funny, quite self-deprecating, and she just writes brilliant melodies.
Great, let's give it a listen. And if I could drive my car, then I would touch it. Exciting sound of John Peel circa 1983. That was La 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 with The Flu, as chosen by our guest Lucy O'Brien. So on to Press, which is the new BBC drama about the press, not about ironing. It's about rival newspapers who are quite literally placed opposite each other in a large Yorkshire town. It stars Charlotte Riley as a disillusioned news editor of a quality broadsheet and Ben Chaplin as a hard-bitten, yes, editor of a tabloid-style rival. Plus David Poirot Suchet as Paul Dacre. I mean, as Ben's Machiavellian tabloid boss. Try say Machiavellian yourself, see what it's like. Let's hear an excerpt.
Mostly, our purpose here is quite a clear one, to entertain.
Our job is the truth.
You really want to do the right thing.
The best layouts, images, the best online.
The most outrageous storytelling in the world. Get me something good or you're fired. Right, are you pleased you're a journalist?
So, rival newspapers, disillusioned hacks, clashes of idealism, government corruption, opportunism, sex, drugs and subterfuge. Some of us have worked in newspapers here. Do we all recognise the drama? Miranda Sawyer, this is about the press. This is about journalists. This is about getting stories. Mm. You've worked in newspapers.
I have, yes. I've actually worked in tabloid newspaper as well. So I have worked very briefly for The Mirror when The Mirror were trying to get middle-class women to read it. They got a middle-class woman in, i.e. me. It's a fairly standard drama, which is fine by me. You know, it's pretty easy to follow. It's quite fun. There's nothing wrong with it. If you work in a profession that is portrayed on the television, so if you're a journalist or a lawyer or you work in, you know, the NHS, you know, anything like that, there will be points where you're like, oh my God, this is just so irritating. It would never happen like that. That is rubbish.
Yeah, wizards and all over the land are saying, Game of Thrones, that never bloody happened.
Yeah, exactly. So you have to, as a journalist, I think there's parts where you have to kind of step back and go, oh man, that headline is just terrible. Nobody would allow that to go past and you call that writing. This is appalling. But there are, and the one thing they always get wrong is tabloid photographers, I have to say, because they always use the wrong cameras. So it's quite basic. Really quite basic. There are elements that are true. I enjoy the tabloid editor. He has elements that are really, really true. So a lot of what he says in order to stand up for himself is absolutely standard across tabloids. It's completely what they believe.
How does he justify this?
Okay, so what he justifies, kind of what people argue against tabloids, is that they say, don't be intrusive, don't wreck ordinary people's lives. And they say, you know what? You want to know the story. You want to know the story, and you will not get the story unless somebody like us gets the story for you. You want it. And so there's a constant kind of argument, a push me, pull you around that. And we see a very young journalist, his first death knock. Now, tabloid journalists, they have to do that. They have to go to people's doors and they knock on the door and they say, we're really sorry to hear that your relative has died. Would you like to tell me the story? They push notes through the door. And the problem that that people generally have is that they feel like that's harassment. And I do think that there are elements of that that's kind of wrong. What we don't see here, which I think slightly didn't ring true, is with the young journalist coming up to get a story, what would happen normally is it would be him and four other people trying to get that story.
Yeah.
So that's what's the difference.
From rival papers.
From rival papers. Right. They would come in, they'd be ringing the door, they'd be going on mobile, they'd be putting notes through, they'd be going around the other way. That's the difference that you don't feel. So that kind of sense of weird competitiveness, although you get it between the broadsheet and the tabloid, that's not actually real life. What is it? It's between tabloids and the Daily Mail and the Express. Yeah. They're all fighting for the same story.
One thing that I thought was quite laughingly convincing was I really enjoyed the exchange with the intern and the Holly Evans character, who's like the deputy news editor.
Yeah, she's the disillusioned hack, isn't
she? Yeah, the disillusioned hack.
With morals.
And so the intern comes up and says, I've emailed all those nurses in the Liverpool hospital, but no one's replied to me. So I don't think there's a story. And then the Holly Evans deputy news editor just gets on the train, goes up there, talks to the cleaners face to face, gets the story, comes back. I mean, I don't know. This would be wonderful if you could get people to resign, wouldn't it? And then, you know, a day later gets the resignation of someone on the health board.
Mm. I mean, I do think that the fact that you have to go out and get stories is very true. And a lot of people
really
think you
that.
Email things and that doesn't really happen. No.
Yeah.
Andrew, what were your thoughts about this whole thing? Well, Is there a drama in newspapers?
I've never actually worked in newspapers. I've only worked at arm's length by sending them things, by emailing them things that they never reply to. As a drama, I thought what they're trying to do is put a twist on the standard cliched newspaper drama, of which there are many. You know, people with hats with a bit of paper saying press on it stuck in them.
I wish.
Gigantic cameras with flashes. So they're trying to do a modern spin on it. Certain of the characters are compelling. The kind of tabloid editor, that's the Ben Chaplin.
Yeah, that's right.
It's you know, vaguely overplayed kind of scenery chewing news bastard. The kind of disillusioned young hack I found less compelling and more one-dimensional. What I thought was incredible was it assumed that newspapers are this kind of booming going concern and these mighty engines of control and power. And you know, when you compare it to, for me, the only accurate portrait of newspapers that we've seen in drama lately, which was the series of The Wire set in the Baltimore Sun, where people aren't talking about the verities of journalism, they're talking about the redundancy package and what's going to happen when there's no newspapers anymore.
Yes.
And in comes the guy from the social networking company that says, hey, it's all about tweets. Yep. I can't remember that actually happened, or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like this felt like a drama that could have been made any time up until about 2002.
Mm. Yes.
But after then, pointless. Well, made no sense.
That's why I thought, gosh, if only we could get people to resign. If only we could get politicians officials to resign.
It was in its own way as kind of as much of a fantasy as Harry Potter. You know, it's like an idealised world of the way newspapers work. One thing I really did like, actually, though, was the David Suchet proprietor character really plays against type. What you don't get is the scenery chewing. You don't get the fake Murdoch. What you get is a man who's saying, I want my newspapers to bring culture and news and elevation. And it's the grimy editor, the grimy kind of, you know, composite of Piers Morgan, Kelvin McKenzie, you know, he's the one driving it down markets. I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
But compared to the great media magnet of television at the moment, Logan Roy on Succession, doesn't even come close.
And also, I would say, having worked in tabloids, that the editor is too good looking.
Yes.
Oh, literally every single, I mean, it's awful to say and it's a blanket thing and I love journalists and I hope that journalism lasts forever and ever and ever, but male journalists are not very good looking and they are very, very, very unhealthy. So, you know, they just don't look like that. They are overweight, they drink too much, they are, you know, kind of, they look unhealthy, and obviously these are actors and we have to relate to them and they have to be gorgeous, but there was just not enough kind of slightly sweaty middle-aged
Bella's a Guardian editor. She was so glamorous with her high heels.
Yeah. But then
I'm saying Guardian.
Herald. It's the Guardian.
I do think the women are more, the women generally in tabloids and in broadsheets are more glam. They just are.
Interesting introduction of glam into the show is the thinly veiled Liz Jones, Katie Hopkins figure who comes in as to sort of disrupt the Guardian by supposedly giving her, you know, coming into possibly interview for a job. It's kind of parodically Joan Crawford, Mommy Dearest kind of thing. Yeah. To me, that really broke the realism of the whole thing. But then I've met a few people like that and they are kind of weird.
The
columnist woman is a weird breed.
I have to say that I don't think, there was a couple of things that didn't quite also quite run true, which I actually think if you were doing a kind of write on broadsheet, then you wouldn't employ that person. You might interview them. I do understand that you would interview them. And you wouldn't publish the pictures of the politician. You would say that these things are happening, we are not, because your USP is that we are feminists and we do not do this.
So this is when the topless pictures of a government minister appear somewhere.
You wouldn't print them.
Subsequently followed by pictures of said government minister doing loads of gack in her youth. So you'd probably publish the latter, wouldn't you, if you were the Guardian, because it has, you know, news value. But what I think, I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think what they say in the show is, we haven't published them, and the complaint of the government minister is, you've just linked to them.
Yeah, I think they wouldn't link. Honestly, they wouldn't link now.
You think so?
No. Yeah.
Do you not think the conversation would be, what's the point in not linking? Everybody can get it in a second.
They wouldn't do it.
I thought that the show was so focused on the big dramas. The dramas between the people, the idea of morals, the idea of the cub reporter, is he selling out by secretly recording a TV presenter, children's TV presenter. When I wanted minutiae, I wanted someone to shuffle in with the crossword and go, I've got 7 days worth, but number two's a bit iffy. And then I wanted another sports columnist or Alan Partridge to come in. That's a real life of these losers.
The intern bit, because suddenly I laughed out loud at that bit.
Right.
I teach journalism students. The amount of times they come up to me and say, well, I emailed so-and-so, but they didn't get back to me. I thought,
Gosh. Yeah. So they're literally scared of the phone, aren't they?
Yes.
So with a programme like The Bodyguard, which most of the UK is watching, does this stand a chance, do you think, in getting a big load of viewers?
You know what? I can see that they've really pushed it almost House of Cards style, because Holly Evans' character is very like the Zoe Barnes character in House of Cards, and that theme of media and uncovering political corruption. It seems to be modelled on that, but I don't think it's got the deftness of writing. I think the scripting is a bit, it's all exposition, it's all showing and it's all telling and not showing.
Let's finish up the show with a special request for young Miranda Sawyer. A few months ago we did one of our regular album that nobody else likes jobs, and she chose Bobby Gentry's Touch Him With Love. Well, it's good news for Miranda, because Universal just released an 8-disc Bobby Gentry box set entitled The Girl from Chickasaw County. 7 albums, loads of rarities, all the Bobby Gentry you could possibly wish for. We're going to talk about this singular artist, one of the first women to write and produce her own material, after one track from this enormous set. This is What Else Ode to Billy Joe.
About Billy Joe anyhow. Seems like nothing ever comes to no good up on Choctaw Ridge. And now Billy Joe just jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge. Brother said he recollected when he and Tom and Billy Joe put a frog down my back at the Carroll County Pictures.
Traffic and travel news. Vehicles are slow on the Tallahatchie Bridge as police are responding to an incident, so best avoid that area. That was Bobby Gentry and Ode to Billy Joe in the charts exactly 50 years ago this week, Statistic fans, and famously it knocked All You Need Is Love off the US number one. Miranda, you are a huge fan. Why do you love the Gentry?
Why do I love her? Oh my goodness. Okay, so I think she's got a lot of elements. So she's got a really beautiful voice. She's amazing at songwriting. So that's the kind of basic thing that you want from somebody who is really good at music. But then also she had a really mad and interesting career. So she, you know, her career was launched with Ode to Billy Joe, which we, you know, you just played. And then pretty much everything after that was always a bit of a disappointment, as far as you can work out, for a disappointment for the record company and for people around her, if not for her. So she had this incredibly compressed career, where people were constantly around her thinking, well, why aren't you being more successful? The first album was really successful. What's wrong with you? But in parallel to this, she was also kind of staging shows. She played at Vegas really, really, really early on, and she staged a lot of shows. She had a television career, unbelievably, which was unlike anybody else's. The BBC basically said, you're really great, you're amazingly good looking, you're really good at what you do. And she had this kind of 4 years of making a television show for the BBC where it wasn't really like a variety show. She just sang her songs and you know, staged them and stuff. And then she decided she didn't want to do it anymore. So the you have that kind of J.D. Salinger mystery of where did she go? Has she jumped off the Tallahatchie Bridge? Where is she? There's a lot of kind of strands around her. But when it comes down to it, basically, she has made a few songs that I find incredibly moving and that are really beautifully done. I think she's... if you buy this box set, and I would recommend that you do, it's a beautiful thing. There's a lovely biography. It's all beautifully presented. It's a great present. You can hear certain points where you think, oh man, if only they hadn't done the production in that way, if they'd just done it in a different way, if you could just hear her voice a bit more. And there's a lot of that throughout, I think, her career.
Did you make much of a dent in it? It's like 180 songs. There's a whole Lost Jazz album. There's outtakes. There's live stuff from the BBC. There's Italian versions.
Yeah.
It's like...
Yeah, there's everything. Everything has been thrown at this. So maybe, you know, but with all these things, you always have to do a bit of editing. You know, I've never, unlike many people, been very interested in the Beatles outtakes. Because as far as I'm concerned, you know, they were pretty good in the first place. Yeah. That's fine. You know, but with Bobby, I suppose I was more interested because some of her songs I think don't quite hit, and so I was looking for other things. I got really excited about the fact that she'd sung a Randy Newman song. I was like, because I love Randy Newman, and then it's not one of his better songs, and it's actually not a great version. But you know, I'm quite glad it's there. Yeah. So I suppose it's like all these things. If you get everything by one artist, you pretty much have to be into the artist to be excited about it. I'm very excited about it, but that's because I think she's great.
I mean, the sound is the dominant sound, because she sort of wanders around a bit. The dominant sound is very loose Memphis soul, loads of space bongos, plucked bass, loads of horns. This is Bobby Gillespie, Quentin Tarantino heaven, isn't it? Lucy, did you enjoy the...
I did, and it did. It reminded me, there's this huge box set for Dusty Springfield called Going Back, and it's got lots of outtakes, lots of acoustic demos, etc. I love that stuff because there you get to see the creative process and you get to see her thinking behind her songs and a sense of her personality, really. And you're right, Miranda, what went wrong sometimes? Something like that version of the Beatles' Fool on the Hill, which sounds like something out of Steptoe and Son. You think, what's she done? But there's others where she sings God Bless the Child, which is amazing. Yeah. And was it Find 'em, Fool 'em? I mean, there she gives Chris a run for her money with her own kind of sexual machismo.
And there's a lot of interesting things about her. So she genuinely did come from... what she sang about. I mean, she came from kind of dirt poor country. That's what she grew up in. And then very, very quickly, she was kind of in Vegas, you know. Yeah. And what was weird about her career a little bit was that she wasn't quite allowed to express herself because they didn't want to alienate her original audience. So, for instance, you know, she was pretty feminist. Well, she was very feminist. She was kind of like, she had no problem with contraception or abortion or women's rights or anything like that. But you can't really say that if you want your fans to be kind of Southern country fans. She wanted to, you know, on the numerous television specials she wanted to do, she wanted to sing Fantasy, which is one of her greatest songs. She wasn't allowed to because the implication is that Fantasy became a hooker. So you can't kind of say that it's morally dubious. Oh. She wanted to have people, drag queens on. No, that's not allowed either. So she was kind of progressive, you know.
Well, I was reading around it. Rolling Stone said, amongst her numerous things like hosting a show on Forces Radio and these massive stage productions with loads of dancers, part of it was including a gender-bending tribute to Elvis Presley performed in a skin-tight, glittering pantsuit.
Yeah. That's she's kind the of, best, yeah, man. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Chris. It's she's Chris the again. Best.
She was quite a complex person. Yeah. And I remember as a little girl seeing her on Top of the Pops singing I'll Never Fall in Love Again and thinking, oh, wow, this woman's really unsettling and really strange and weird and scary, but loving the song at the same time. And so I think she had a very unusual energy that they didn't know how to market.
I agree. And also that vocal, it's interesting because some of the stuff in the book I don't agree with. And they say, I don't like the vocal on I'll Never Fall in Love Again. It's slightly forced. But I really love that vocal because it is slightly forced. That's the point.
Yes, exactly.
I did a bit of nosing around to find famous fans, and they include Roseanne Cash, Beth Ditto, and Dave Vanian from The Damned. Dave Vanian, big Bobby Gentry fan. So there you go. it's a big old world. Stan, did you enjoy it?
Yes, I used to listen to Bobby Gentry non-stop in my early 20s, and Delta Suite's one of my favourite records ever. And what I love about her is the vulnerability of the voice, even more than Dusty, I think. There's something really human about it. And she was not ashamed to say, I'm from a working class background. I'm going to write about it. There's all this detail about where she comes from, the South, you can feel it and you can sort of smell it. And I think maybe that was the problem with marketing her, is she didn't want, there's no aspiration. It's not Dolly Parton where I'm going to be this glamazon kind of early. She is very much herself, as much she looks a bit like Elvis in those wonderful 70s album sleeves that she has. And I'm really pleased that more people, I hope, will listen to this person who sort of, as you say, gave an oof to people. She's so influential.
It's almost the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing over a jug of Chickasaw Moonshine this weekend? Lucy O'Brien, what's your closing time chatter?
Oh, right. I want to talk about this new artist called Tommy Genesis, who... and this is a question I'm kind of throwing out there. I think she's disrupting the male gaze. Her latest video has her drawing on a window with fake menstrual blood and sitting there with her legs open and cramming lots of dollar bills.
And
wearing not very much as well. And I think, yes, there's some interesting points there, but is it a distraction from the music? And is it ever a good thing to just sell yourself on your sexuality if you want to be taken seriously as an artist?
Are you getting conservative as you
Maybe I am.
There?
Maybe I'm just like a ranting, boring old fart.
20-year-old riot Maybe. Lucy. Riot girl Lucy O'Brien would have been all over this. She would have gone, yeah.
Yeah, but I would urge people to sort of have a look. I mean... It's a tricky one. I mean, she tries to ride that fault line of wanting to look sexually alluring and at the same time sell a huge amount of records. And that's always a really tricky one. I mean, Miley Cyrus, when she did the Wrecking Ball video, she said that she was in control of the process and the whole thing, but has since spoken out against it. And then... Oh. Famously, the director, Terry Richardson, is now persona non grata in the industry. So...
Miranda's doing a face.
Terry Richardson.
Yeah. Okay, well, so that's Tommy Genesis. Have a look, listeners, but make sure the kids are out of the room. Miranda, sorry, what have you got for your closing time chatter?
Okay, well, it couldn't be more Guardian if I kind of... You know, this is as Guardian can be. But anyway, the Guardian are actually doing a series about walking in cities, which I always find it's absolutely great, but they never mention the fact that it's all right for Will Self to wander around the city in the middle of the night, but it's slightly different if you're a short woman, but never mind. Anyway, one of the things that they have mentioned, or there's an article about, is a town in Spain which took the decision to become pedestrianised in the middle, and it's changed the nature of the town, as it would do. Now, I used to be, I'm quite pro-car, I like driving. I used to be very, very concerned if towns became pedestrianised in the middle, because I thought it kind of killed a heart of something around it. And I still have slightly problems if they become very touristy. So, you know, Trafalgar Square is not really a place. Yeah. It's a kind of gathering for tourists. But I do find it interesting if you can manage, if there is a way of managing cities so that at times there are no cars. And because obviously you have to do deliveries, you know, at times when there are no cars and at times when there are, and what that would mean for the general populace. Because, you know, it's nice to see kids playing football in the street, and that doesn't really happen unless there are no cars. It's nice to wander around in a street where you can actually hear things. And so I just find the idea quite interesting. There's lots of comments, as there always are, under every Guardian article saying this is a load of rubbish, I live there and it's just not like this. But I just think there is a conversation to be had around the nature of cars polluting cities, and this is one of the ways that you could start it.
There we go. Let's pedestrianise the high street. Sian, what have you got?
Oh, it's also about town planning. Billy Fury Way. Billy Fury Way in West Hampstead, which has had two murals of Billy Fury because he recorded at Decca, which is now the English National Opera around the corner. There's one mural that got to face-to-face council plastered it over. They decided earlier this year to do a new mural of Billy Fury, which almost looked like him, and had his widow, Lisa Voice, the amazingly named Lisa Voice, come and do lots of local paper stuff about it. She was really proud. It also coincided with album release. And it's been covered up again, but no one knows who. Council say they're not doing it, but they would have done it if it had been an album advert. No one has fessed up to completely covering up Billy Fury's face. It is a local enigma. Apparently Billy Fury Way is where you get robbed anyway, and they found human poo. Feel that somehow, can we get together and make Billy Fury Way a bit better, please, for his memory?
Is it the continuity Gene Vincent front just wanted to...
That's what I'm wondering, yes.
I mean, I've seen Billy Fury Way. It's not a glamorous little highway,
is it? It's not good. And if I was the ghost of Billy Fury, I'd be a bit annoyed.
That goes over. Yeah.
It's a small alleyway by the railway.
For listeners outside London.
Yeah. It goes from West Hampstead to Finchley Road.
Yeah. 20 years ago, there was human poo there.
Yeah, there's human poo.
Well, I hope it wasn't the same one.
So, yes, I think we need an orchestrated campaign for poor Billy Fury.
Poor Billy Fury. He deserves better.
Yeah, he really does.
Well, my closing time chatter could not be more different. It's the mystery lockdown of Sunspot Solar Observatory on Sacramento Peak. Mysteriously, the solar observatory in wherever Sacramento, California, somewhere, was locked down by the police. Everybody was evacuated and it was not explained why. The internet then explodes. They found aliens. It's aliens. There's an alien working there. Somebody's infiltrated it. X-Files, Doctor Who, Quatermass, the lot. It becomes compounded still more by the fact that Sunspot Solar Observatory overlooks the nearby White Sands Missile Range. It's like a setup for the best, at least a pretty good Doctor Who.
Definitely.
And then it turned out that actually it was just some kind of tedious, like, employee threatening to kick off in the canteen. So I'm heartbroken by this because we're now so conditioned to be ready. I'm so ready for the alien invasion. I've been ready for 30 years. I thought it's here. We're finally going to get it. And then I was swizzed out of it. But I think we should watch the skies. We should be more alert for this kind of thing.
I think either you should write a drama about it or somebody should make a record.
Mate, it's writing itself. That is basically written itself. And that's it. That's the end of the show, or at least the main bit of the show. Thanks to our guests, Miranda Sawyer and Lucy O'Brien. Are you going to stick around for the extra bit for Patreon people in a minute?
Yes,
of course you are. Remember, listeners, you can get the extra bit at patreon.com/bigmouth. You can get all of our past episodes at audioboom.com/bigmouth. We'll be back next week. If you're not a Patreon supporter, please do. And thank you to our guests. Thank you very much for coming in. And thank you, Sean. And thank you, producer Jack.
Thank you.
And we'll see you next week.
See ya.